Thank you, gracious God, that you continue to speak. And as we walk on holy ground this morning, please help us to be aware of who is speaking to us. Not just a man, but you, the God of all. Amen. Well, join with me in a scene for a minute. Imagine you enter a very somber, wood-paneled room. And you take a seat in the gallery. Soon, a person wearing an orange prison-issue set of overalls comes in. And you see his family in the gallery, a couple of rows in front of you. The trial begins. The charges are announced. They're serious charges. The first witness is called. And as she speaks, her testimony seems clearly to point towards the innocence of the defendant. More witnesses are brought in. And more facts pile up. They're all pointing in the same direction. The man's innocent. Slightly odd. Maybe a little bit of a difficult character. But there's no way he's done what he's been charged with. The judge is saying little things that show you that she can see that he's innocent as well. You see the relief start to show in his family and the way they're sitting. Their shoulders kind of relax. You can imagine they're getting excited about his release. The final arguments are given in the trial. The prosecution's still calling for conviction, but their case is clearly flimsy. Then the time comes for the verdict. The judge raises her gavel, and she pronounces guilty as charged. Before you can catch your breath, the man's taken away. How are you feeling at that point? Outraged? Shocked? It's a travesty. Everyone knows he's innocent, but he's convicted all the same. Trials often get us engrossed because there's a lot of drama. That's why the courtroom TV dramas and movies have always been very popular. But it's more than just entertainment. It's more than just drama that grabs us. We have an inbuilt sense to want to see justice done. We have an inbuilt desire for justice. We hate to see an innocent person convicted of something they haven't done. Well, the last three readings that we've heard from the Bible, from the Gospel of Luke, are basically part of a big real-life courtroom drama that happened in the city of Jerusalem on the first Good Friday, just leading up to the first Good Friday. And the man at the center of this drama was Jesus Christ. And he faces three trials in the course of this. One is before the Jewish authorities. Another is before the Roman governor, Pilate, and that one's broken into two parts. And the third is before Herod, who is the ruler of Galilee, the area that Jesus came from. But perhaps the most astonishing thing about this trial scene is that if you look hard at it, as we'll try and do this morning for a few minutes, we'll find ourselves in the courtroom. If you look carefully, you'll see yourself there. So please do come with me into this scene. If you've got a Bible, open it to the end of Luke chapter 22. If not, that's okay. But first of all, as we go into this scene, Jesus is tried before the Jewish authorities. And this is a pretty quick trial. Verse 66, little number 66 there. The council of the elders, which is the leading Jewish authorities, they meet together at daybreak. Jesus is led before them. And they ask Jesus to tell them if he is the Messiah. That is, if he's God's king. Jesus answers with a sort of a cryptic saying. In effect, he tells them that he knows they're not really looking for the truth. He knows they've got their own agenda, and they're not really looking for the truth. But all the same, in verse 69, he says that from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God. And that's a picture drawn from the Old Testament, part of the Bible written before Jesus came, from Psalm 110. And that's it's a passage about the Messiah. So, in effect, he's saying, in a kind of cryptic way, I am the Messiah. I am this king. Well, they nail that down a little bit more, and then they basically say, we've got all we need. He's condemned himself. He's claiming to be the Messiah, the Son of God. They know they can get him in trouble for that. And so that's the end of the first trial. Jesus is guilty of claiming to be the Messiah. And they take him to Pilate, the Roman governor, for the second trial. Israel was under Roman rule. Israel, where Jerusalem was under Roman rule at that time. So the Jewish authorities probably couldn't legally sentence someone to death, which is what they wanted for Jesus. So they needed to take him to Pilate, the Roman governor, in order for that to happen. And they make their charges against him. It's in chapter 23, verse 2, big number 23, just near that. The three charges they make against him are, firstly, they accuse him of subverting the nation, causing trouble, like a revolutionary or a rebel. He's subverting the nation, they say. And secondly, they say he's opposing payment of taxes to Caesar. Now, that's a straight-out lie, because actually, Jesus said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, when he was asked about taxes. In other words, he said, yeah, pay your taxes. So that was a straight-out lie. So they say he's subverting the nation. They say he's opposing payment of taxes to Caesar. But thirdly, they accuse him of claiming to be the Messiah. And that's true, of course. We just saw that. But they're very clever. They're clever lawyers at this point. Because they make sure Pilate knows that the Messiah is a king. And that means he's a rival to Caesar, the emperor, Pilate's boss. So that puts Pilate in an interesting position. So are you on your boss's side or not, Pilate? So Pilate asks Jesus if he's the king. Jesus is sort of mysterious again. He says, you have said so. But despite their clever accusations, Pilate can see through them. He's no fool. He can see through them. He can see that Jesus is no threat to the peace. He's no real threat to the safety of the nation or anything like that. He's no real threat to the emperor. So he gives a verdict. Pilate gives a verdict. Verse 4. I find no basis for a charge against this man. No basis. Still, verse 5, the Jewish leaders insist Jesus is stirring up the people, causing trouble. Now he says that Jesus has been causing trouble since he came from his home in Galilee. And Pilate hears that. And at that point he sees a way out from this annoying mess. You see, Pilate doesn't really want to have to argue with these difficult Jewish leaders about this man that he can see is innocent. So with a politician's eye for avoiding the issue, he realizes that if Jesus is from Galilee, he can send him off to the ruler of Galilee, to Herod. And then Herod can deal with it. Not my circus anymore. You deal with it, Herod. So he does. He sends him off. Pilate sends him off to Herod, who happened to be in Jerusalem at that time for the big festival that was going on. And he's probably only 10 minutes walk away from where Pilate was. So Pilate gets rid of the problem, sends him to Herod. And now it's trial number 3. And to cut a short story even shorter, verse 8, Herod is delighted to see Jesus. He'd been hoping that Jesus might perform a sign for him. He was hoping, in other words, that Jesus would do a party trick for him. He wanted Jesus to entertain him. He wanted to see this amazing person who'd done these amazing things. It's like having David Copperfield. But fascinatingly, verse 9, Jesus doesn't say a word. He just stands there silent. He's like a sheep before its shearers, silent. Even as the Jewish authorities stand there and accuse him, he remains silent. Because if you come to Jesus just wanting him to do a trick for you, or just to perform for you the things that you want him to do for you, well, you might get silence. Jesus doesn't play the game by our rules. Verse 11. Herod and his soldiers then mock Jesus a bit. They dress him up like mock royalty, making fun of this person. Still, he did not open his mouth. Then Herod sends him back to Pilate uncondemned. So Herod mocked him. Herod made fun of him. But he didn't condemn him. And that shows that Herod's verdict on Jesus, despite all the mocking, Herod's verdict is not guilty. So he goes back to Pilate. And Pilate hasn't completely gotten out of dealing with it, so the trial with Pilate continues. Straight away, Pilate calls the authorities together again. But this time, verse 13, he calls the people as well. The people of Jerusalem become part of the trial. They're almost like a cross between the crowd in the gallery and the jury. The people are part of the trial. And Pilate gives this crowd a bit of a judge's speech at this point. I'll read it again. Betty read it so well, but I'll read it again, just so it's fresh in our minds. Verse 14. onwards. He says, "You brought me this man as one who is inciting the people to rebellion. I've examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us. As you can see, he's done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I'll punish him and then release him." And the same verdict for the second time there. No basis for the charges, Pilate says. So Pilate's going to kindly let Jesus go with just a beating. Just a little bit of unjust punishment. Kind of you, Pilate. Verse 18, though, the crowd won't have it. Oh, they've got no problem with Jesus getting an unjust beating. No, they just don't want Jesus to be free. They do not want Jesus released. The whole crowd says, "Away with this man. Release Barabbas instead." Now, Barabbas was someone who was in prison for insurrection and murder, it says. The crowd would rather have a murderer than have Jesus. But notice, what was the other crime that Barabbas was guilty of, as well as murder? Insurrection. What's that? Rebellion. Now, what was the charge against Jesus? Rebellion. That he was a rebel. So the crowd is asking Pilate to release a man who is guilty of what Jesus was on trial for, but Jesus was innocent of. The crowd want this violent man who is guilty in place of Jesus who is innocent. They have the guilty man go free in order to have the innocent man condemned. In verse 20, Pilate tries again to convince them because he knows Jesus is innocent. But now they're in a frenzy. The crowd's in a frenzy. Crucify! Crucify! They want nothing less than death for this Messiah. Crucify him! This is the Lord who claims too much from them. Crucify! Be rid of him! For the third time, verse 22, Pilate the judge protests that the prisoner's innocent. What crime has he committed? I've found in him no grounds for the death penalty. That's the clear verdict for the third time. He's not guilty. He's innocent. But the crowd keep shouting, verse 23. They demand his crucifixion. And it's time for the final verdict. Three times, Pilate has declared this man innocent, that there is no basis for the charges. And the verdict comes, guilty as charged. Guilty. Yes, guilty. Listen from verse 23 again. With loud shouts, they, the crowd, insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who'd been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for. And he surrendered Jesus to their will. He hands Jesus over to the will of this mob. Can you picture that? This angry mob. And Jesus is handed over to them. It's an ugly scene. The guilty one goes free. The innocent one is turned over to the mob. It's an unjust exchange. And that is the reality of what happened to Jesus. In a city, in our world, a city that you could still visit if it wasn't for COVID, that's what happened there. It was a deep injustice. We're used to seeing crosses as pretty necklaces or signs on church buildings. But a cross is a place of a torturous death. And that's what Jesus was handed over to be crucified at the demand of this crowd, hung on a cross until he died painfully. Jesus' cross was where the innocent, loving king was torturously put to a grisly death. It was a terrible injustice. But as we've looked at it closely, have you seen yourself there? Did you see yourself in that story? Did you see yourself in the crowd? The people. Now, before this, in Luke's gospel, the people have been very positive towards Jesus. A couple of days before this trial, Jesus was so popular with the people, they loved him so much, that the religious leaders were too scared to arrest Jesus because they knew the crowd would riot if they arrested him. But now, the people are calling for Jesus' blood. The mood had shifted dramatically. Public opinion had shifted. The culture had changed. They'd rather have anyone than Jesus now. I wonder if you can see yourself in the people. I'm afraid I can see myself in the people too often. It's okay being positive about Jesus when he's saying things that are popular, like love your enemy or don't judge. We're all positive about him then. Or when you're around people who like Jesus. But when he becomes inconvenient, or when he demands of your time, or when the crowd you're with aren't so positive towards him after all, how easy it is to turn away from him. How hard it is to push against the crowd, to say, actually, I'm with Jesus on this one. Or even just to insist on giving him a fair hearing. Or to do what John said, to actually get on with not just keeping him at a distance, to walk in, not just walk past. How hard it is. Did you see yourself in the crowd? Did you see yourself maybe in Pilate? He knew Jesus was innocent. He knew that Jesus wasn't guilty of these things. And to be fair, he tried to convince others of that for a while. But as the shouts got louder, he lost his nerve. This trial should never have even got as far as Herod, let alone ended up in the cross, because Pilate knew that Jesus was innocent from the beginning. He should have stood up for truth and released Jesus. But Pilate didn't want to have to deal with it. And in the end, it was just too hard to keep siding with justice, too hard to keep siding with the innocent one, too hard to keep siding with Jesus. He gave up. Can you see yourself in Pilate? When the crowd shouts loudly, not to take Jesus too seriously, not to risk being associated with him, it can be so easy just to give in. And there are plenty of voices, loud voices in our society shouting at the moment. Some of them will shout over and over again and say that you must not disagree with them. And some of them will say, you don't want to be with that Jesus. The things that he stands for are bad things, the wrong side of history. It's so easy when the crowd shouts loudly, even if you know there's something to Jesus. It's so hard, so easy to just give in. Do you see yourself in Pilate? I know that I do at times see myself in Pilate, to my shame. But above all I see myself, and above all I think we should all see ourselves in Barabbas. In Barabbas. We are Barabbas. That person who was exchanged for Jesus. That person who was guilty but was set free. See, Jesus had been quite clear the night before this trial scene that he would die for us. He told his disciples to share a meal to remember him by, one that remembered his body and his blood given for us. And at the end of the meal, he said it was time for him to fulfill the prophecy that we heard from the book of Isaiah that Saskia read. He quoted from the end of, Jesus quoted from the end of that prophecy. He identified himself with the person who's pictured in that prophecy, the one who would be pierced for our transgressions, who would be numbered with the transgressors. And now, in this trial, the one who's clearly innocent is condemned to death as if he were a transgressor. He's condemned to be pierced for our transgressions. That happens to him and the guilty one goes free. It's an exchange. And you and I, we are Barabbas. We've rejected God. We've rejected Jesus, God's Messiah, at many points. Each of us in one way or another. You may not think that, but it is true. We've treated him with contempt. We've ignored him. We've disobeyed him. We've dishonored him. We've walked past him when we know we shouldn't have. We've denied him. We've not taken him seriously. Whether it was because his demands were too inconvenient, or because it was too unpopular to live his way, or because we just don't want anyone to rule over us, because actually I prefer ruling my own life, thank you. Whatever it is, in some way, all of us have denied him. And that, of course, makes us rebels. And not the cool sort of rebels like in Star Wars, or the people who are standing up to the man. Not that kind of rebel. Rather, rebels against the God who made us. The God who gave us life. Rebels against the one true hope for peace and justice in the world that is there in Jesus. Rebels against him. We're guilty at a cosmic level of exactly what Barabbas was guilty of. What Jesus was innocent of. And let me say, it's not just this group or that group. That group I don't like. that are guilty of that. It's not just this person or that person. It's not just the person next to you. It's you and I and the person next to you who are like Barabbas at that point. But that's where this exchange that happened on Good Friday is transformed into something wonderful. Because Jesus knew exactly what he was doing at that point. Yes, he was at the mercy of the people. Yes, he was suffering due to Pilate's weakness and the Jewish leaders' hatred at one level. But at a bigger level, at a higher level, this is exactly what Jesus came to do. All through the Gospels, he says, this is necessary. It was the exchange that he came to make, that he says he had to make, where he died in our place, where the Son of God gave himself in exchange for me and for you. So, if that's what the situation is, if we are Barabbas, what should a Barabbas like you or me do? Well, firstly and most importantly, we must accept that we are Barabbas. We must stop making excuses that we know really are excuses. Oh, I'm not really, it's not really, we've got to stop making those excuses and accept we are Barabbas. And that Jesus made that exchange for us. You need to accept that you need him to die in your place. You need to say yes to what he's done for you. To recognize that he went to the cross for you. And you can do that simply by saying a prayer. Surely we'll confess our sins to God and accept his forgiveness. And that could be a way of you accepting what Jesus has done for you. Yes, I know I'm Barabbas and I need you to die for me, Jesus. Or you can see me afterwards and I'd love to pray with you about that. Or you can pray to God on your own later. God will hear you. You can accept Jesus' death in your place. But when you do accept that, it has many other wonderful effects. And let me mention just one key one to you. Accepting your Barabbas and that Jesus died for you means that a defining thing about you and about me is that we are guilty ones who are set free. We can't justify ourselves as if we're okay in our own right. If you accept this exchange for you, it means accepting that we're guilty before God. But acknowledging that leads to something wonderful, kind of counterintuitively, so stay with me here, but it does. It leads to something wonderful. Because if you accept that, then you are set free from the chains of having to justify yourself. We spend so much of our lives, in our hearts and our minds, and even out loud, justifying ourselves. It's not my fault because I've done this, I know I did that wrong, but I did this and this and this good. And it's exhausting, isn't it? Having to justify ourselves. If you accept that you are Barabbas and that Jesus died in your place, you are set free from having to justify yourself, from always reminding yourself and telling others about what you've achieved, about who your family is, about where you went to school, about what your job is, about how successful you are, about what a great business person you are, about how morally brilliant you've been, about how it wasn't your fault because you did this and that, about how many people you've helped, about how just or on point you are with social issues, about how important you are to the church, about how long you've come to the church, about what kind of parent you've been, about what a dutiful child you've been, all the good acts that you can list to justify yourself. That becomes exhausting, doesn't it? Because there's always more to do. And we all know that we fail, even our own standards, let alone anyone else's, let alone God's. Even when we don't like to admit it, we know that. And it's exhausting trying to justify yourself all the time. If we are Barabbas, and we know it, we know we can't justify ourselves. And we don't have to. Because even as guilty ones, we've been loved enough that the most perfect, innocent one was willing to be condemned in our place and to set us free that we might be called not guilty. And in a strange and profound but true way, that is a better identity than all the achievements, all the moral uprightness, all the religiousness, all the status in the world. So will you join me and give up on self-justification and rather accept the wonder that Jesus, the Son of God, died in your place? We're going to play a video now. Part of a song called A Beautiful Exchange. which is about this exchange that Jesus made for us, dying in our place. Now just take a moment as this video plays and the music plays to quietly reflect on what he's done as we listen, the one who has died in our place.